You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome back to Earth Station Trek, a show where we trek from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between. I'm Charles Kelso, and it's my privilege to introduce the Earth Station Trek crew, Keith Johnson.
Don't reverse the polarity, just yank it out.
Alan Seiler. And Veronica Daschle.
Hi. I couldn't hear that at all, Alan.
Yeah, I don't think that Zoom picked you up. But
no.
What? Oh no!
Those watching at home will get it. The folks in the audience.
Oh, that's so disappointing.
I know.
Keith, we got some This Week in Trek this week.
Yeah, we got a couple that they're rather significant for interesting reasons. On the 28th of April, 1965, the teleplay was finally delivered for a show that a lot of people do not like in the original series, but that show is the Omega Glory.
Okay.
And you remember that when that's the one where William Shatner as Captain Kirk, a native Canadian, had to do the preamble for an audience. And I understand that when he was doing the, and I'm going to do it like Shatner, we the people had to get a lot of instruction because he didn't know the Declaration of Independence or anything, of course, by heart. Why would he? He's Canadian.
Yeah.
It's the Omega Glory.
I guess Schoolhouse Rock hadn't come out yet for him.
Oh, there you go. No, it had not yet.
In the 40s? No, it had not.
No, that's too bad.
The Omega Glory is one of those episodes where a lot of people say, and I agree, it starts out really, really cool. The whole thing with this weird virus that turns you into dust. And then Captain Tracy, that's for those that remember, it's the one where Captain Ron Tracy thinks he's discovered a fountain of youth. Then he turns nuts, tries to kill Kirk. And then toward the end, it's Kirk basically violating the Prime Directive, possibly, and telling the people that they need to follow the Constitution of the United States. What's significant about it, as you guys may know, this was one of the key episode ideas that Gene Roddenberry had written by hand and typed out on March 11th, 1964, as one of his ideas for this new series, Star Trek, and it's one of the ones that he considered for the series pilot, which is very
I like that episode. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but I like it. You don't want to think about how everything is happening, but it's very much in that mid-century sci-fi where it's just a parallel Earth.
I seriously don't think it would have worked as a series pilot, though.
No.
Yeah.
It's fine where it is, but I don't think that would have worked as a selling point to launch an entire franchise.
No, but I think it's one that the network execs could wrap their heads around.
True.
Which is part of the pitches is here's some stories that Bean counters can understand.
Of course. Even you people can get that.
Yeah. What I like about it, it's a very weird, interesting thing. It's just one of the few times Captain Kirk gets beaten in a fight because Captain Tracy beats him in a one-on-one fight and then he picks up an axe is going to basically hack him up. So it's a very interesting, and you got to think about this show in the 1960s, a guy picking up an axe and getting ready to try to hack up somebody. Yeah, that probably went over real well for primetime audiences at the time. Nowadays, nobody looks at it, you know, twice.
Now they'd be disappointed if he didn't hack him up.
Yeah. This is an odd one. This may or may not be a good thing, but 30th of April, 1912, way, way, way back, when movies were still really new, several people came together and created a venture that they didn't know if it would work. They founded a little outfit called Universal Studios.
Okay.
Wow.
And boy, we don't have time, guys, to go from the history of what, and I'm sure you know, we do not have time to go from the history of what's called Universal Studios to what is now called Paramount and all the crap in between, like Gulf and Western and Desilu. I don't even want to go down that path. Let's just say Universal Studios started then.
Okay.
Yeah, and then, of course, Universal Studios has been incredibly important with the world of Star Trek. And like I said, there were others. There was Gulf and Western, and then there was the thing with Desilu from Lucille Ball. But ultimately result in what we now call Paramount. Kind of, sort of. So I guess if they, I guess if this wasn't done in 1912 and if Lucille Ball didn't sign off on the show she didn't understand, then we wouldn't have Star Trek now. One more. We don't do birthdays much because you can do birthdays forever, but this one I think is really important. And Charles, you know where I'm going to go with this. 1st of May, 1923. This gentleman is still alive. Star Trek director, original series, several episodes, including
Ralph Sineski.
That's the guy. Yeah. Ralph Sineski. This guy is 101 years old. Jeez. The only living director from the original series, unless I'm mistaken. Yeah. Directed, he's like up there with Mark Daniels for having directed the greatest number of original series Star Trek.
Right.
I've seen him in podcasts and stuff recently, still spry, still has better memory than frankly William Shatner does. Just amazing. And it's just amazing listening to a guy who's talking about all this new Star Trek, and he was back there when he was directing stuff like Mission Impossible. And this is crazy. A couple of weeks ago, I was watching The Waltons. I was watching an episode of The Waltons, and it was a really good episode of The Waltons, and it had the second Doctor from the original series. I always get those ones mixed up. And it seemed like it was a really good episode. It's like, this thing is flowing well. And I hate to say this, the camera work looked good. And at the end of the episode, it's directed by Ralph Sineski.
Right.
Wow.
Wow.
Talent will out.
Yeah, that's amazing. And there's so few people who actually worked on that show who are still around. I mean, it's mostly Absolutely. Younger actors who are still around, like the people who played kids on, like, but the adults who were, like you say, born in the 20s, who were adults during World War II, who yeah. are still active is, or still alive even, is pretty low number.
Absolutely. And the last thing, this is so much, this is original series day. This is just significant because these are two seminal episodes. On the 3rd of May, 1966, final drafts were submitted for two episodes at the same time because Roddenberry was rushing people, like, we got to get these done. Those episodes, final drafts, were The Cormorant Maneuver and The Enemy Within. And okay. as they say in Marvel Comics, enough said, just yeah. classic episodes from the original series. Those are series. Good ones. Yeah. And that's This Week in Trek History.
Awesome. Well, today we're going to be talking about the Star Trek Discovery Season 5, Episode 6, Whistle Speak. But first, let's take a quick break for a commercial. And when we come back, we'll go into spoilers and talk about Whistle Speak. So stay right there.
Love music from rock to soul, from prog to rap, from funk to metal. From the 70s, 80s, 90s, and now? Then check out Modern Musicology Podcast. Join hosts Alan, Stephanie, Anthony, and Rob for a wide variety of topic discussions and interviews with musicians, producers, authors, and more. As always, keep rocking on.
Spoilers today.
Okay.
You should whistle that.
It was different.
Well, it won't come through, apparently.
So, yeah, that's.
Well, how okay. come it worked for her and it didn't for me?
I
got closer. I don't,
oh, well, I don't that's okay.
It might be your pop filter. Maybe your pop filter was.
It better. Could be. Or it could be that the universal translators were offline at that moment.
That's I don't true. Know. Well, today we're talking about Star Trek Discovery Whistle Speak, which is another planetary adventure.
Yay,
planets!
I know. I commented today on I think it was Trek Movies post about it, that I think Star Trek Discovery visits more Strange New Worlds than Strange New Worlds does.
Nice. That's a point.
Yeah. So what did everybody think?
This was fun.
Okay.
I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, right, I thought it was good too. And Alan and I talked briefly about it earlier, but I wasn't over the moon about it or anything like that. But yeah. I thought it was a fun. It's a good episode of the week. It's a good planetary adventure. I liked seeing Burnham and Tilly on an adventure together.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me, like, when Burnham and Tilly were in the race, it made me think of all those scenes in season one when Burnham and Tilly were like jogging in the corridors.
Yeah.
On
yeah.
Discovery.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking as well.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly what I thought. Yep.
Was that not what you thought?
Yeah.
Oh, you're saying that like you're being sarcastic.
Oh, no, no, no.
Oh, okay.
No, I really honestly did. I was like, yeah, that's a nice little callback to where these characters began together.
Yeah, I thought so, too. That's what we've been talking about all season, is that they're doing a good job of calling back to the early episodes.
Yeah.
And yeah, I thought that was a lot of fun.
I was just bemused by your miming of the jogging.
I don't know what joggers do.
That was so like that was so animated series.
Yeah, I didn't love it at first, and it was fine. Like I didn't dislike it. One thing I have definitely noticed about this new season is you can definitely tell this final season. You can definitely tell that there's different writers and production crew and even directors, because the show looks different. It just looks different. It still looks great, but it just looks different in a lot of ways. And I could feel that, notice that, the camera angles and how everything looks. I agree with you. This does feel more like an original series episode, because they're outside and they come up with a very interesting ritual. I did write in my notes, it's like, oh yeah, eat the little cube that they hand you on the alien planet. And
that's what I was thinking. I was like, is this a psychotropic?
I know, right? Thank goodness it just made
me thirsty. I don't take a little white sugar cube looking thing from strangers, sorry.
Right.
I know, right? And so it was okay, but what I did like, and what did feel very much like traditional Star Trek, was at the end when they start basically talking about Prime Directive, which we'll get into, you know, basically, do you do what you should do? And then even Rayner goes, yeah, you're going to have to answer for Prime Directive violation. Now, if there's anybody who probably is violating the Prime Directive in that time, I would think it's Rayner, but essentially, or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe he's more actually by the book than we tend to think they are. Charles, you pointed out last week, because I forget, is Burnham and crew are in the future, but they're from a time of Kirk, even before Kirk slightly. So violating Prime Directive was probably kind of normal, maybe, for them.
Yeah, certainly probably more so than it would be in Picard's time. In Picard's time, it was like, even if they don't know about it, you can't do something to affect their culture. Whereas Kirk was like, well, the Enterprise is in danger. I guess I'm going to have to knock this whole civilization over.
Let me roll through a couple of comments.
All right.
Elaine Sweatman. Hello, Elaine. Says, they got my hopes up about possibly seeing the Denobulans. Right? 100%. And Matt Sweatman. Hello, Matt. Says, a good planet adventure with a Prime Directive problem to work around. And we definitely want to talk about that Prime Directive thing later on. Now, this was an episode where we had three, let me get my fingers in the camera, three, like, plot lines. We had an A story, a B, and a C, which was Burnham and Tilly going down to the planet to kind of find the next piece of the puzzle. We had Adira being given a bridge shift, not for the first time, so I don't know why they've made such a big deal about it. And but you know, we had them doing you know, a thing with Adira, and then we have Culber, who was trying to work through his own spiritual crisis and making a connection with Stamets, who he wasn't sure he would be able to talk about this with. So three sort of interesting little, you know, plots going on at the same time,
right?
Two of which are related.
My first thought when I saw Culber and Stamets interacting was, oh, Alan will like this. They're interacting and being a couple, almost, sort of, kind of.
Aw, that's so sweet that you thought of me.
Yeah. We still didn't get a lot of interaction between them and Adira. Mm-mm. But it was nice to see Adira getting something to do. And nice to see Rayner's progression as becoming a leader of this group, you know, and more mentory and that sort of thing, and not just telling everybody to shut up.
But I do like that. Somebody brought something up to him and he's like, well, let's just do it now. So Adira apparently off camera says, hey, I would really like the opportunity to do more bridge stuff. And apparently that was like earlier that day, because when it happened, Adira was like, well, I didn't mean this afternoon. And
I think that's why they were nervous. They were not expecting a bridge shift. Usually a bridge shift is pre-planned and I can hype myself up for it, but they were
But also Adira is nervous about everything anyway, so
that's true. And I do like that.
I'm getting a little tired of that.
I like that about Rayner, though, because that is a nice pivot for his sort of his crusty demeanor to be like, no, sir, I think I should get the bridge every now and then. Like, great, you're up.
Exactly.
Go fire up the science station.
You know, I will say what that reminds me of. That is absolutely true life. You know, those of y'all who are in the creative fields know about what they call the elevator pitch. You know, the whole thing where if you see somebody, whether it's you truly meet some movie director in an elevator or it's your boss at your job, sometimes you have 2 minutes or 1 minute to convince them and they may say, okay, do it. And you're like, oh, well, I was really just kind of thinking about it. So I do think that was very realistic.
Yeah, I really more wanted you to tell me I had a good idea, not for me to have to actually execute it.
Matt jumps in to say, last week, the Culber crisis came out of nowhere, but at least they did try to seed his storyline before this episode, which I totally agree with. But, you know, another aspect of that is I just think it's hilarious that Culber, even though he obviously has counselor training, you know, a lot of times medical people are their own worst patients and they don't really see their own problems like they do in other people, but he's trying to find a physical or medical explanation for what he's feeling when what he's feeling is just a spiritual thing and it doesn't have any physical manifestation and it's not caused by something other than the experience that he had. And I thought that was just a neat angle. You know, I thought it was really cool that he just didn't, you know, they made that point of him always having the answers for other people, you know, and he doesn't have answers for himself. And I really liked that a lot.
Yeah. And initially when he was talking to the simulation of his grandmother and he was approaching it as a spiritual thing, and she was like, well, you're a doctor. You haven't scanned your brain yet. And he's like, oh, that's a good point. I should go scan my brain. But, I mean, we hadn't really seen another thought came into my head while I was talking about it. We hadn't really seen the holodeck used that way, where it's scanning your brain and creating someone in real time either.
That's a new development, apparently.
Yeah, I wonder if that's going to be an ongoing thing on Discovery as like a working out your problems thing is...
That'd be cool.
I mean, also, you could bring anybody back that you want to bring back.
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's a way for people to make guest appearances on the upcoming Academy show. So.
True. Yeah. Or you could, if they decided to do I keep wanting to see Lorca. If they did a Lorca, they could have, you know, Burnham talking to Lorca.
True.
Just put that out there.
That's true.
Or Ethan Peck. He's probably easier to get.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, either that or her parents.
True.
Her adoptive parents. That would be nice to see again.
Her mother's still out there in the 32nd century, so she really could just go talk to her mother.
Well, I was thinking more of Amanda.
Oh, I got you.
Adoptive parents.
I got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess that's what I was thinking as well when you said mother. I forgot that we met her actual mother.
Yeah, her mother's wrong.
Oh, we've met her actual mother, yes.
Yeah.
I forget that.
That strikes me as one of those things and technologies that you would just become used to in time. It's a cultural thing, because as much as I miss my parents, talking to what looks like a representation of them would creep me out. You know, it's one thing when people would do the things where they would look at home video and pictures. I do that a lot. But if there was a 3D image of my mom that responded like her, it would be really weird to me. But again, that's a cultural thing and a societal thing and a time thing, because, you know, there are people who do that now. There are some people with money who clone their dogs and cats who died. Even that's a little weird to me.
But that's exactly what I was thinking. I mean, having your abuela, who is long gone, having an interactive conversation with you, that's weird.
It is to me. Yeah. It would be very strange.
Okay. So number one, I absolutely want to cuddle clone of Muffet, my dog.
Aww,
number
sweet.
Two, I would love to have a holographic image interaction with my dad and ask him so many things, because so much has happened since then. And a lot of it relates to his past and some stuff that I found out about his past, and I want to ask him about it. And I mean, it would be like a program thing, so it wouldn't be an actual answer.
Yeah, it would just, because it's scanning your brain. So it would just be whatever's in your brain already.
Right. But I think I would enjoy that.
Okay.
I would probably be bawling, but you know.
Yeah.
But Federation citizens, there's a computer record of everybody, whether they're in service or not, right?
Yeah.
So at least it's extrapolating also from whatever personal logs, his grandmother made or anything like that. It would sort of pull from all that stuff as well as your own memories or whatever.
There was a Black Mirror episode about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've had the ability in Star Trek for a long time. Like Wesley Crusher interacted with a pre-recorded hologram of his dad one time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But I think the difference this is supposed to be like scanning your brain to get the image of what I got from it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, this is more like the unfortunate Leah Brahms case with Geordi, where he scanned all known records and then she responded the way he basically wanted her to respond.
Right.
Right.
That kind of it's a philosophical thing, because like you said, Alan, to me it would probably weird me out. And then the way I would look at it is, you know, it sucks, but death is a part of life. So would you ever be able to kind of move on and let go if you could talk to this avatar of your love?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's good or bad. And then I also think about the Uncanny Valley, because like you said, Charles, unless somehow they honestly had a straight up brain copy of your loved one, even with every bit they ever said, the computer's not going to be perfect. And so I wonder if it'll always be like something is not quite right with that person. It might just be slightly off. But one thing I did like about it, and what Alan was saying about the spirituality, is this is it's cool to see Star Trek kind of address spirituality. I will say Star Trek has never Star Trek, even back in the time of Kirk, they never denounced or put down religion. Of course, in the original series, every god was an obvious alien or a computer. So Kirk was like, yeah, we got to kill this thing. But even in the original series, Kirk didn't put down belief specifically. Deep Space Nine, of course, is all about belief. And I know even Sisko and Janeway in their episodes, when people would ask those questions, do you believe? They would always say, I believe there are things we don't understand. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Star Trek has never put down religion. So well, I love the way he did that.
I was going to say, and who watches The Watchers is pretty putting down religion.
Yeah.
Yes. That one. I think Picard and them at times could certainly be dismissive of, and then a lot of Star Treks are dismissive of the beliefs of the places they go to. Like it's rare to get something like Deep Space Nine that, they take the Bajorans seriously, but also the Bajorans' prophets showed up in the first episode, So it's easier to take them seriously because there they are, you know, they're they're talking to them. Whereas like you say on the original series, it'd be the god would be a child or an insane computer or both.
Right.
And then,
an alien.
Right. But on Next Gen though, who watches The Watchers, for instance, this society had already evolved beyond having religious beliefs. We've introduced it. And that's, now we've regressed them, that's just an assumption.
Yeah. Then you have Worf, who was very spiritual. So they would kind of try to balance it.
Yeah.
But what I loved about it is, and that's one of the interesting things about Trek, there's religion and there's spirituality. There are people I know who are spiritual and aren't religious. There are people who don't believe, period. But what I love about that is the ultimate lesson here, Cole, with him was you can't overthink it. And even the person closest to you, the love of his life, if they don't get it, that just may be fine. Because at the end of the day, it's kind of like, well, as long as you're happy, as long as you can work with it, maybe I'll never understand it. He may never understand what he's gone through. And it maybe that's okay. And
he won't ever understand what he's gone through, because he was inhabited by a completely different entity.
Right? Yes.
And, Culber has been through some, what.
Yes.
And for him to be as affected as he is by this experience being so profound for him. Yeah. There's no way that Stamets can ever understand that unless he goes through exactly the same thing. And even then it'll be different for him.
Yeah. But I feel like Culber will reach some sort of realization about it by the end of the season.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%.
So, yeah.
But I think that's better, I think, than old Star Trek, where you get possessed by an alien and then they're gone. And the next week it's like, it never happened.
Yeah.
Yes.
We never saw O'Brien dealing with what happened to him week to week on a long-term basis and having to seek out counselors and talking to people about it. Mm-hmm. But I think that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I think that, in reality, if another person or another entity from outer space inhabited your body for a bit, that would be strange. You'd be left with questions at the end,
Yeah.
Okay. A couple of related comments by Matt Sweatman. So for people listening or watching, everybody knows that Matt and Elaine are currently watching through Next Generation and they're on season two. And this is Elaine's first time seeing all this. So Matt says, oh, I can't wait for Elaine to see the Leah Brahms appearances.
Oh,
and then he says, I liked Michael's reactions when the natives were questioning their religions. She supported their beliefs without saying that she shared them.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, she was very diplomatic about that, and she was doing it quickly and in the moment.
Yeah.
So that was very impressive.
Yeah, we've seen that from her before. Like, even earlier this season, and she was more respectful of like the alien statues than a lot of other fictional characters in general would have been. Like, let's blow up the old statues and get what we want and get out of here. Whereas she was a little more respectful of the fact that even though this civilization has been gone for 1500 years, I guess by this time, 2500 years, you know, respectful of the fact that it was someone's belief system.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, let's go restore it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, what she said.
Go ahead, Charles. No, I was going to say the opposite of what you're going to say. So you go first.
Okay. I love what Michael said, because as an amateur astronomer and scientist and engineer, I've dealt with this my whole life. I was raised in a religious family. My late father was a preacher, and I have had people in my circle go, how could you possibly believe in a God or, you know, spirituality when you study cosmology and quantum mechanics? I'm like, dude, I don't know what is and isn't out there. I don't trip on it on that level. If you don't believe, it's fine. To your point earlier, Charles, as long as I don't start, and I would never, as long as I don't start backing inquisitions or religious persecutions, it's okay.
You know, what I was going to say was, I kind of missed the old atheist sci-fi where they're like, are there gods out there? And they're like, no.
No. We should now call that the Stargate SG-1 effect.
Yeah. Well, how do we like the planet? We got to spend a lot of time on a planet this week.
I thought the culture and their belief was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really like their ritual and the way that they went about it and how they had that backstory and why they did this particular thing to go into the temple, mm-hmm. even though obviously the priest could go into the temple whenever they wanted because they knew how to get in.
Right. Mm-hmm. But here we do. We have another, I don't want to say primitive, we have another less advanced race, culture, whatever, mm-hmm. who sends people off to die.
Mm-hmm.
Like basically they're practicing human sacrifice and it feels like everybody is very respectful until it comes to that point. And it always comes to that point. Yes. Mm-hmm. These people are basically sacrificing themselves. Now, I loved Tilly's reaction when they're in the room
and
she's like, wait, what?
Right.
Oh, my God.
I actually didn't see that coming.
I didn't either.
Yeah, I didn't think sacrifice for some reason. I didn't see that coming. Maybe because the whole running around in circles without water was kind of sort of silly to me. And then when it turned that, I didn't know it was going there.
Yeah. I wasn't thinking about it at the time, but I didn't find it surprising that this alien civilization sent two young women up into the temple and then they expect them to, you know, that's sort of a trope, but, I thought it was well used here. I did think that like whistle speaking would be a bigger part of this episode.
Yeah,
me too.
So did I. I mean, it's the title, for God's sake.
It's the title. They have it at the beginning. At the end, they add a little whistle speak. But it really is. I mean, it didn't have much to do with the plot.
No.
No.
And I thought it was
a title, basically.
Yeah, I thought it was a really neat device, basically. I liked, you know, the explanation for it. It's like whales, like sperm whales do these loud clicks that can be heard like an ocean around the world, basically, because they're so loud and they travel so far. And so this whistle speak is a language that's developed in order to communicate over great distances. And I thought that was super interesting. And I really would have liked to have seen more of that. And for it to be the title of the episode, I would really have liked to have had it as like part of the plot. Like there was something about it that, you know, was integral to what was going on. Otherwise, I mean, it was just a really neat, trivial thing, but you know,
right.
I also want to know how whistles carry better than speech. I know I can't whistle. Frequency?
They're not using StreamYard.
Okay, but I have a pretty high pitched voice.
No, higher pitched voices do carry further, and higher pitched noise do. That's why most like GPS and Alexas and things have female voices, because it's more easy to hear than deeper voices that don't carry as far.
Yeah, but I still feel like I can project at a normal volume I louder than
I feel like
I
you can't hear yourself.
Louder than I can whistle.
I can hear you from some distance away.
Right, but not whistling.
Okay.
But for these people, they can.
Yeah.
It's just weird. It's just weird to me.
Okay. I my first thought when they got down there and they're like, and now there's a foot race. And I was like, oh, of all the freaking times not to have Saru around. This is the perfect time for Saru. He would smoke him.
Speaking
good
of,
good point. I didn't even.
He's just completely, they just completely dropped Saru. Completely.
For now.
He'll come back.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I do miss seeing Saru. I was hoping to see more of like his week to week stuff.
Yeah.
But if they're going to have three storylines going on, we don't also need Saru. Hopefully they're saving him up for something good and not just like the last time that was kind of a lame negotiation. Hopefully next time will be a little more substantive.
Yes.
All right. Elaine says, it reminded me a little bit of the Paradise Syndrome. There was technology that is there to protect / help the planet that is failing. Mm. And Wayne says, in all honesty, I thought the whistle speak was being translated by the computer. Well, but they have both things. If they're speaking over distances, then they whistle.
Right. It was being translated for our characters. But for the people on the planet, they're just hearing the whistles and understanding them. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, but in close proximity, they just talk to each other.
That's true. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's what they're saying. In like conversational speech, they just would speak phonetically like we do. But over distances, they would whistle. But yeah, as far as the computer translating, it was when they were hearing the whistles.
Yes.
For our characters.
Yes. Elaine now says, also, I want to know what kind of sources Kovach has to be able to get a yellow legal pad.
Well, time traveler.
Maybe it was a white legal pad 2,000 years ago. And now it's a yellow legal pad.
Time traveler.
Wow.
100% guarantee. He will be reeled as a time traveler.
Maybe.
Of some kind.
They seem to like to keep him mysterious.
Yeah.
I feel like that's one of the things they would have gone back and wrapped up, though.
Maybe. They might. Mm. I like Kovic. What do you think about this Infinity Room?
I don't know. I'm more impressed by that as far as like his resources than I am him having a legal pad. Like he can just like pull Burnham in for a conference at any time that he wants or something. It seems very, even for 32nd century, for what we've seen so far, it seems very advanced.
Yeah, it seems like anytime the ship's in danger, you could just be like, all right, everybody into the Infinity Room.
Right.
And then from there, we'll go back to, you know, just Starfleet Command. Like it seems like a physical place she's going to.
Yeah.
And instantaneously across whatever distances they travel.
Yeah.
Which I mean, whatever technology you're using for that, just fly the ships through that. Maybe that's the pathway drive for, you know, who knows. But
Ooh. Yeah,
the Infinity Room, it seems a little bit strange to me. It would be different if it was like a psychic thing, which would still be weird over that far a distance. I was still worried about that, but less so than her physically going there.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let me pose a question. I'm just wondering if this is a little bit jumping toward the end here. I'm just wondering if anybody else felt like the debate, the struggle around breaking the, what do you call the thing? The Prime Directive. Was done too easily and without any real discussion or any real consequences.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it just kind of felt like an expediency and like, you know, I'm going to run in and I'm going to do this thing and everything works out for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just earlier this season, COVID, you know, made what they thought was a bad call, which wasn't even a Prime Directive situation, really. It was just endangering a population. And that he didn't even do, by the way, the bad guys did. And he had like an inquiry that was presided over by the president herself the next day and got demoted. And then this week he's like, well, are you sure about breaking the Prime Directive? And she's like, yep. It's our highest law, but
right.
Not this week.
Right. You know, I don't know. I felt like there wasn't any real consequence to it.
Yeah.
Now, maybe there will be.
Maybe.
It's very possible that that is going to be a factor in an upcoming episode. But for right now, you know, like the aliens of the week went along with it and everything worked out nicely. And there wasn't any real, I mean, it wasn't the point of the episode like it has been right. in some of the ones in the past. So maybe right. I'm wanting too much from it. I don't know. Mm.
What did you think, Keith?
Yeah, I thought it was a little quick, too. I also thought in the original series, because this has happened many times, I think of Landru and I think of Vol with Kirk. One, they always made the ship in danger so that Kirk had almost a real justification for killing their god, Apollo, who was a living being. But the other thing is, yeah, I think because I remember and actually what happened with both, especially Vol, as Kirk said, the Prime Directive referred to a living, breathing society. And even though this society and growing society, even though the society was functional, it could be argued that their death cult, as it were, came up because of technology that someone put there, which even though it was the Denobulians, kind of you can say, because Kirk would say, well, this is some technology that somebody else put in place, which caused them to go down this path. Therefore, I have the right to kind of like reveal myself if I have to, because I'm just kind of undoing the wrong. Now, in those episodes, you never heard him getting called for an inquiry because Spock was like, I don't know about that.
Right.
But
yeah, the I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I did expect a little more debate because in the original series, even though Kirk always ended up breaking it, there was true debate about it all the time.
Yeah. Well, that was why it existed. It was just to create dramatic tension because, of course, Kirk is not going to let everybody die on the planet or let the Enterprise be destroyed.
Right. Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, but I agree with Kirk in that. In that situation, like if a society of 20 people exists to feed watermelons to a robot, then that's not a society that you should be giving your life to avoid, you know, interrupting, you know, that. But yeah, in this case too, this Denobulan scientist already monkeyed around with this planet.
Right.
So yeah. I think she would be more justified, but I would be very surprised if they have 4 episodes left of the series that they're going to burn time debating her decision from this episode.
I completely agree with you on that.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a one and done. All right. So let me get a bunch of comments have come in about this Prime Directive thing. And I think that Matt agrees with me because he says that was an opportunity for Staples ad in the show. The easy button. That's hilarious. Wayne says, Kovich reminds me of the smoking man from the X-Files. That's a guess since I've never seen a full episode of that show.
Okay.
Matt says, so the only consequence of violating the Prime Directive is you have to fill out paperwork.
I love it, Matt.
Good one.
Just fill out paperwork.
I feel like Weird Ears should fight that.
Oh, I'm so glad that Weird Ears has caught on now and other people have adopted it. Wayne says, agreed with Charles and Alan, and really that's the most important part of the comment. I just wanted to read that part.
Well said, Wayne.
But thank you. But he says the Prime Directive was treated like an over the shoulder comment. And now Elaine says, could it be because there was already alien tech there that it didn't seem too far of a jump to let them know what was really going on? Stop trying to put logic into this, Elaine. Come on.
And see, I was thinking, oh, they obviously already knew about technology because when Burnham finally convinces to open the thing, he opens this panel and pulls up this thing and turns it and pushes it back down. And that's obviously technology. That's obviously not like magic or anything.
But that's also seemingly the only thing he knows. He doesn't know all the other complex stuff that controls weather and makes rain.
But I mean, surely this planet, they've got these flip open rocks that have computer panels inside, just like around on the trail. So somebody eventually is going to discover this and flip open a rock and be like, what are all these isolinear chips doing in here?
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. We should start pulling these out. What are these?
They're going to stumble when they're jogging.
Right.
You make a good point, Veronica, because I was trying to figure out that they know technology because in ancient Egypt, 3,000 years ago, they had steam-driven doors to certain temples. And if you walked up to the temple, they basically rigged up what we would nowadays call a steam engine to open the door. And it never went anywhere, obviously, for like another 2,000 years. So I don't know if, even though he was twisting these knobs, maybe he still thought it was magic. I don't know, because the other thing I will say was that may be the most chill response to discovering alien life I've seen in Star Trek in a while. He's like, oh, are you from, oh, you're really? And are you gosh? Because no, we're not gods. We're people. He's like, okay, I can save my child now. And then he had a very chill reaction to that. And even the fact that after centuries of killing people. He said, oh, what are we going to do? The people won't like that. She goes, I think there's a couple like that lady we say. She'll be cool. He goes, okay. It was a little weird. Yeah, it was kind of quick. He was real chill with that.
It was like, oh, neat.
I feel like this is where Second Contact comes in, and they show up there, and they're like, we're rioting because they don't want to let us sacrifice people anymore.
Yeah, the Cerritos J.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
What a great idea. You're right. They leave, and everybody's happy, and then the Cerritos pulls right in, and they're like, they're like burning down everything. What a great thought. I never thought about that.
I wish we had seen a Cerritos J or H or something in this show. Gosh darn it.
That'd be awesome.
Oh, that would make me so happy.
One little cool scientific nod, when I noticed when they pull back and show the planet, was the area of green, and I guess the whole point is that entire world is basically surrounded by dust storms. It was hexagonally shaped, which is what, if you look, it's the same shape of Saturn, our planet Saturn. There's a giant, and I'm talking thousands of miles wide, hexagonally shaped storm on Saturn. It looks incredibly unnatural because it's got the angles, and it's basically created by several different storm fronts colliding. And basically, it's like the old days when you had a projector. When it all collides, it actually formed something that looks like almost like a stop sign. So I think that was obviously what they were doing, and I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, awesome. That is neat. Yeah, I mean, the space stuff still looks great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Discovery across the board. It's amazing how detailed this stuff is now, you know, compared to what we grew up with, you know?
I had a weird thought because somebody once said about the episode in the original series, this side of the Paradise Syndrome, that's the one with the Native Americans on the planet, right?
Yeah, the Paradise Syndrome.
And then somebody had always mentioned it, that the preservers were all fired so powerful. Why did they take Native Americans to a planet where they had to put a freaking asteroid shield in place? And so sometimes when I see, because like all the stuff the Denobians did with that water reclamation thing, I looked at the planet, it's like, dude, just move them somewhere else.
Yeah,
I mean,
this planet's awesome.
Yeah,
because they're clearly not adapted. Like, this can't be a natural environment because, like, they're like hacking and stuff coming out. they respond to a dust storm like we would.
Yeah.
So this must have been like a development on their planet that was relatively recently. They didn't evolve in this environment, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
But I would have liked to have found out more about the Denobulan. It seemed like Janal we found out quite a bit about, and the Romulan scientists we found out quite a bit about. But then the rest of them have just been sort of name drops, and before we get their backstory off screen, I would like to see and learn more about these different scientists.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, we finally got the list of names of the scientists that are involved in this thing in this week's episode. So in the, what was it, the going to the first or second clue, the clue was intended to make the reader think of Beta Z, right?
Right.
But instead, when you find the second half of the clue, it leads you to Trill. Then now we know that there actually is a Betazoid involved in this thing, and we're probably going to go to Beta Z.
Maybe, or just where the Betazoid went.
Well, yeah.
True. I would love to go to Beta Z.
Yes.
Me too.
Yeah.
But did you notice on the list of names, the Betazoid is called Marina?
I did see that.
I saw that.
That was so sweet.
That was cool.
Yeah.
I got to tell y'all, if it was up to me, we'd still be on the first clue. Because the logic they worked through from that distilled water to water reclamation, I was like, I never would have got to that. I never would have made those connections.
I'm glad this isn't an escape room. We'd all still be in there.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
A couple of comments from Wayne. He says, on being accepting extraterrestrials are visiting their world. Wow. What was in those cubes?
Right?
All right, Wayne. Right? He was so chill. Now, maybe because he got to save his child, it helped him. But yeah, he was.
That's what I was thinking as well. All his brain was on, I'm going to save her. This can save her. Okay, I'm going to just accept this because this can save her.
Yeah, but it was really, it was incredibly calm response. But now, guys, really make me think, what happens when they leave? Because I mentioned another podcast I listened to. They used to always say there were no rearview mirrors on Kirk's Enterprise.
Right.
Because, you know, he would go, that's what we call whatever. You're going to like it a lot. And then you get in the ship and leave. And you never know what happened.
You imagine an alien landing like in your backyard and being like, you need to change your society and your religion's probably wrong anyway, so I gotta go. And you're like, well, cool. Well, I gotta go.
I know, right?
Yeah. Right. Like, I don't have any say over that. Otherwise, I would have changed it.
On the next step in our quest, Matt says, I really hope there's a wedding going on when the Discovery arrives at Beta Zed.
Yes, please.
I would be surprised. Discovery isn't that kind of show.
No.
Discovery, surprisingly for being a modern show, is like less horny than a lot of the old Star Treks were.
Less so than Discovery. So
yeah. Occasionally you'll get like a shirtless shot of a buff guy and that kind of thing. But
we haven't really gotten much of that, though.
With the exception of some of the stuff in the first season. With the Klingons.
Okay, there was a little Klingon stuff that was weird. Yes. But yeah, generally speaking, yeah, Discovery doesn't really go in for that kind of thing.
No.
Yeah, and what's her name? The Empress, Giorgio from the Evil Universe, was basically getting it on with several people when they first discovered her. Mm. Also eating Kelpians, but other than that.
Yeah. Right. Matt says, Enterprise would have shown that in a heartbeat. Yeah, because it would have happened in the decontamination chamber.
Right. Indeed.
You don't even need to go to Beta Zed for all that.
Indeed.
That's true.
One thing I thought was interesting, and I guess they've said it, I thought it was interesting, is Tilly and Michael had a conversation where she basically said, what was the lesson we were supposed to learn with this clue? And so is that what it is every single time? There's a lesson. They're thinking there's a lesson with every clue? Yeah. Because the one she said today, right?
That's what Book said last time.
Yeah.
Yes. Basically, like, have you noticed there's a lesson that we have to learn?
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah.
Because they're setting these challenges up to find out who is worthy and who isn't worthy. And the whole point is to weed out the people that aren't learning as they go and aren't picking up on the clue behind the clue.
Yeah. Like, you have to be ethical in order to pass the test. It's not just a matter of figuring out a puzzle or else anybody could go.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we've seen this before.
What was the moral of the story this week?
Yeah, I kind of missed it at the end. What did they say? I forget. They said at the very end of the show.
I don't know. I just don't sacrifice people.
Always share your water. I don't know.
I meant to write it down, but I ran out of time. I can't remember what it was. Expect the unexpected or something. It was something. It felt like they were reaching just a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I feel like the whole, like, story and the sacrifice part came along after they built the thing and put the puzzle piece in there.
Yeah,
because the whole story of the running around with the water and going in there and sacrificing herself backstory, that was after that was already in place. Mm. So that couldn't have had anything to do with whatever the morale was. So
yeah, that's true.
Where was the moral of the story?
They said it at the very end and I didn't write it down. I meant to rewind and I didn't get to.
Well, hang on. Yeah, I'm going to pull the episode up and then I'll be right
back. we didn't get to watch the last like 10 minutes.
On our second watch.
Yeah. The other one was at 5 a.m. So I don't remember it.
Was the understanding when you were one of the people, the supplicants who were trying to get into the temple, do you know that you're going to die? Is that pretty obvious that you're going to die? Is it because the father knew that his child was going
to die?
Yeah, I
think it was just surprising to Tilly.
It was only right.
It's one of those alien culture things. They don't tell you that at the start of the contest.
Yeah.
Because they assume everyone knows. If you don't know, why would you not know?
None of these planets are litigious, apparently. Because on Earth, you'd have to sign a waiver. And
because the reason I was wondering,
Keith, you muted yourself.
Yeah.
We've had this on real life cultures on Earth, like the Incas and the Aztecs and so forth. Mm-hmm. What I found really interesting is if you're trying to pay the elder sacrifice, one person 2 seconds in, drinks some water, and he goes, it was a noble attempt. Go with God, basically. I'm like, well, dude, you know, unless I've been programmed like on a Taste of Armageddon, where they were programmed like their culture is like you should sacrifice. I'm like, if they choose me, I'm like, okay, I'll just run around a couple times and drink some water. And they're like, okay, dude, thanks a lot. Thanks for participating. I'll go home.
Right.
Most cultures like that. You don't get to get out of it.
Yeah, but this one, you had to volunteer to be one of the people. It's not like you were chosen.
Right.
Yeah, but think about what you could do. You could really raise your social status by volunteering, making it look really good. And then, like, you're like, it's me and Charles running. And I was like, Okay, Charles, you got it. Dude, you're so much better than me. And I drink some water.
I'm going to keep trying.
Yeah. I go party and Charles walks into the temple. I'm like, he was a better man than me, but I'm alive. It's an interesting culture, but it all goes back to how you acculturate people to, you know, there are cultures where that's the whole point. Sacrificing yourself ultimately is more important than living. So I guess that's what they are thinking in that case.
Right. Yeah.
About this question that we have raised, Wayne says the writers were eating those cues too.
Wayne, you're really getting on them cues, brother. Yeah, now you got me thinking, what's in those cues?
Yeah.
Dust.
Pretty much, yeah.
I like that we keep getting planetary adventures, though. And we haven't had an episode like this in a while. Right. I mean, I guess you had the Strange New Worlds one last year where they went back to sort of Rigel. So they had on Picard, there was none of this kind of thing. There's no like planets with cultures and things like that. So this is something that Star Trek used to do a lot that we don't get a whole lot of these days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, on Picard season two, we did, but it was just Earth. It was just modern day Earth. So they could just shoot outside the Paramount lot or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, it's not the same.
But even like all through Picard, there's not a single episode, I don't think, where they show up at a planet.
No.
You know, where there's, they go to like, I mean, they were the planets, but it was like a planet of Romulan colony or a planet of gangsters and that kind of thing. Not like an unknown planet where they have to disguise themselves and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right. And certainly no exterior locations. Right. It was all like just in a room somewhere.
Right.
Yeah. Earlier, Wayne had pointed out about, that infinity room, and it reminded him, and he reminds him of the cigarette smoking man from the X-Files. Mm-hmm. That kind of infinity room thing is incredibly common in science fiction and comic books. So when I look at it, it kind of pulls me out of Star Trek very slightly, only because I've seen it in a lot of other science fiction. It's just weird. I don't really think one way or the other about it. I think I like it better than Sarek reaching across the universe to mind meld with it.
So agreed.
I'll go with that.
Yeah.
Yes.
At least this is like, for me, they get more a pass because this is the 32nd century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agreed.
You know, there's a lot of their technology that it's like, well, it's way in the future. You know, it's like 1,000 years later. That's fine. Mm-hmm.
But speaking of which, they were also doing that in the 60s. Like, the 90s is thousands of years away. It's
right.
Fine.
But I mean, as far as being something that's beyond what Star Trek can usually do. But at least this is way beyond what Star Trek can usually do. But speaking of which, they have the tricorder in their eye now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't realize about that. I was trying to figure out what it was because I missed the brief mention of tricorder eye when they landed. I was like, why do they have a weird color eye? And why are they suddenly able to see through rocks? What's going on? Because I missed that comment the first time around.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you missed the episode, you'll won't understand what's happening. But no, I thought it was, I mean, it's like in the old days, you could like sort of snake your tricorder out of your pocket and boop, 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 and put it back in.
Right.
But
right.
with the big hologram ones, they had to come up with a reason, like a way to do it because you can't have them with a big hologram.
I feel like that's also a reasonable advance in technology because I mean, we're partway there already with like the, AR.
Yeah.
Glasses
and certainly, stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And certainly as a step forward from visors that blind people are using in the 24th century, I think it's a very natural step.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny y'all said it. I thought the same thing. That was technology, unlike those personal transporters, which I'm not arguing the technology, but the usage. But I agree. I thought that was completely logical with those. Mm-hmm. With those things in their eyes. Also, Charles, you made a good point. How many times over the years of Star Trek have they been in some primitive culture and they have to sneak the thing out and then it would make a beeping sound and they have to be just opening it up with like, you're demons or something. So
right.
They still need really a more like private way to have communications with people. Because even still, like, you got people on speakerphone all the time everywhere you go.
Yes, 100%, and especially when they're in that chamber where Tilly and the other person is supposed to be, you know, going to get killed after they seal it off. Everybody should be able to hear exactly what they're saying.
Right.
I mean, Tilly is talking to Burnham over her little whatever, and I mean, it's not that big a room.
Right. No.
Like, and it's stolen, so it's going to echo.
If you've ever been in a grocery store with someone who's talking on a speakerphone, like that's Star Trek characters on every away mission. They're just walking around these planets talking out loud to people.
Yeah. Right. I think that's one of those they do for the dramatic, because even now in real life, we've been experimenting with subcutaneous implants. Like you can put something at the base of your skull so that the sound carries through your bones and your head. I mean, we've been working with that for quite a while. And so, yeah, by then, they definitely have a technology like that. But, you know, that kind of goes with the whole thing of they never seem to have cameras in Star Trek on away missions. Like, you know, they always do these great things where Riker be on the thing of Picard, what's going on, Captain? This is hard to describe. Like, if you had a freaking camera.
Exactly.
Until you have to have it for a trial or something. And then there's perfect footage of whatever happened.
Right. But right. One time. They fitted Geordi's visor with a camera one time, and they never did it again. That made no sense.
And it wasn't even part of the plot of that episode.
Nope.
No, it was just a cool thing.
Right.
It was like, look at this cool thing we could do that we're never going to do again.
Right.
I mean, we have dashboard cams now because things happen in traffic, and you know, you got to be able to have evidence, and they haven't thought about that for away missions over centuries and centuries and centuries in the future.
Why doesn't their little comm badge that you just go boop boop and they just poof anywhere? Why doesn't that have a little camera on it?
Yeah, you should have. They should have Starfleet body cams.
Exactly.
Gosh,
oh my gosh. Okay.
Subcutaneous implants. I love it.
Wayne says, "I'm shocked that no one had thought of the tricorder eye sooner." Right. Mm-hmm.
I agree.
And Elaine says, if I can talk on my phone through my hearing aid without anybody else hearing my conversation, they should have already figured this out. Very true. Oops. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Well, I thought this was a fun one. Like, it wasn't my top episode of the season or anything like that, but I thought it was a good Star Trek of the week adventure on Alien Planet. I like seeing Bernie and Tillum on an adventure together. I still can't do it.
Bernie and Tillum.
I'm just turning them into a shipper couple now.
I like Tillum best.
We didn't mention it, but we got a few mentions of Starfleet Academy thrown in there.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
And then her saying, ooh, don't tempt me.
Yeah. As somebody last week, one of y'all mentioned, why is Tilly on this mission all this time if she's supposed to be doing Academy stuff? So did she run away or something? I mean, is she just taking a leave?
I think Burnham specifically asked for her maybe this mission.
You need her for the red directive, and so you get who you want.
Yeah.
But maybe they're setting up Burnham to appear in the first episode of Starfleet Academy.
Yeah,
I would not be at all surprised if that happens. I'm feel certain that's going to happen.
I feel like Sinequa's going to make appearances, but she's not going to be a regular character because based on what I've been hearing from her in interviews, she is looking at pulling away from the acting community.
Oh,
really?
Well, because she said, I've been struggling in this industry with my growing spirituality.
Really?
Yeah, I remember her saying that with her interview with Tawny Newsom. That was something she said. So I feel like she might be pulling back from appearing and just doing certain things.
Hopefully one of those certain things is Paramount Plus movies.
Indeed.
Because I will watch them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think she makes a amazing captain. So I hope I hope she does continue doing Star Trek stuff, even if it's just every once in a while or a movie every couple of years.
Yeah, I don't care what else she does. I just wanted to do Star Trek.
Yes.
She's a very faith-based Alabama girl. So, heck, I hope we don't end up just seeing her on Hallmark movies all the time.
No, I don't think she would do that.
Yeah, but also, I think she has 7 years is a long time. And I think she's a mother and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, two kids.
Maybe you don't want to do, you know, the TV schedule anymore, which I would get that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, speaking of Starfleet Academy, we didn't mention it. We didn't do a news thing, but it just occurred to me that they permanently renamed the studio where they've been filming Discovery all this time to the Star Trek Studio.
Yeah,
really?
Which I thought was cool. It has a big sign that says the Star Trek Studio in big letters.
Nice.
And they had a picture of like the Discovery cast outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's
so apparently this happened a while ago because the Discovery cast was still there in costume.
Right.
Interesting.
And the right cast, too, because it wasn't the new bridge people that nobody knows. It was the older ones that nobody knows.
Except, And final for me, Charles said something very interesting I thought was interesting, which was that this wasn't a great show, but it wasn't a bad show. And it's so funny because when I look at a lot of the stuff people talk about on Star Trek, and we've said several times, there's, given you're talking hundreds of episodes, there's very few Trek I truly dislike. Even the shows that are kind of meh, they build the world. This feels like that kind of track. Like if I never, I don't need to go back to this planet again, but it added to the world. That's a cool planet. And it does feel like Star Trek. And I hate using that term. It feels like Star Trek because I don't ever want to say this ain't Trek. This is Trek. But I like the, it just makes me feel like I'm going on an adventure and it's fleshing out that world. And I do like that about this season.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we've talked about that before, but not every episode has to be the best or the worst the show has ever done. But sometimes it's just it's good Star Trek this week.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it, and it, you know, it really kind of put me in mind of season two, the second episode, New Eden, where they go down onto a planet and they investigate this local people's religious beliefs, and they have to decide how to interact with them, and they have to decide on what they can and can't do in the Prime Directive in relation to these people. And for that reason, I really enjoyed it.
Mm. I agree.
It was good. It was good.
And I can't wait till we do our Stargate Star Trek comparison show, because we'll talk about how O'Neill and them basically always showed up with their weapons drawn. And as Charles said, they were like, "Hey, Google, they're not false gods." Okay.
Well, now we don't have to because you already have.
Right. All right. Well, Keith, where can people find more of you?
On X and Facebook, primarily the ESO Network Facebook groups.
And how about you, Alan?
CosmicCreative.com. And I have an announcement that will be going out tomorrow morning. This is the first of, this is part one of a two-part announcement. The second part will be in a week or so, I think. Maybe 2 weeks, we'll say that. Mm-hmm. So, a new announcement tomorrow morning.
Awesome.
Yay.
Now, Veronica, don't you have an announcement as well?
Yes.
Oh, yes. So, yes. Dragon Con is doing the first, at least at Dragon Con, and we're pretty sure it's the first ever shadow cast of Subspace Rhapsody. So it's going to be the Subspace Rhapsody picture show. And I was cast as Pelia.
Congratulations.
Yay! I'm so excited.
That is so awesome. I'm so excited.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm excited. Good it's going to be you. Awesome. Yeah. So
so if you're at Dragon Con this year, come see.
Yeah.
What's it called?
Subspace Rhapsody picture show.
Yep. Yep, and Veronica will be signing autographs right after.
Yep,
that's right. And that's going to be.
we don't have a firm time yet, so stay tuned for.
Oh, nothing does. Yeah, it's way too early for Dragon.
Way too early for that. We'll find out the firm time like the week of.
Right, because they'll set it, and then it'll change, and then it'll change. So
right.
But I was going to say something else. Never mind.
Where else can people find us, Veronica?
Feltnerdy.com.
Yep. And if you're in the Lawrenceville, Georgia area this weekend, May the 4th, we will be performing at there's a big free comic book day going on in Lawrenceville, and we'll be at the Aurora Theater performing a Doctor Who themed show, which is fun. It's only like $7 a ticket. It's all ages. So everyone come to Lawrenceville. It's a little Comic Con going on up there.
Yeah.
And next weekend, which is May 10th and 11th, we'll be in Knoxville, Tennessee at FrankenCon, performing an adult performance on Friday and a family all ages performance on Saturday. So everyone come out and see us.
Indeed.
Very
and
cool.
Where else can go find us?
Monkeying Around, a podcast about the monkeys.
Yep. Where we just celebrated our 50th episode and did our first live on YouTube bit. So you can subscribe to the Monkeying Around podcast on YouTube or follow us on your favorite podcast platform at Monkeying Around. And we've got some really fun, interesting guests lined up coming up soon.
Yep.
Ooh.
And Veronica, do you have a closing for us this week?
I just like the feel of real paper.
Perfect.
Good job.
That's awesome.
All right, y'all.
I don't know if that was a exact quote, but close enough.
It is very close. Everybody have a great week. See you next Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern.
That's right.
Thanks for participating.
Episode 7.
Wow. Final stretch.
Thank you for listening to Earth Station Trek. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a positive rating. You can also send us feedback at earthstationtrek@gmail.com. You can join in the fun on our Facebook group or follow us on Twitter. You can also visit us online at earthstationtrek.podbean.com. We'll see you next time. Live long and prosper.
This
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.